I have a sermon today with a provocative title. I could have used many different titles, but I chose the most provocative one. And that is, how many members will go to the place of safety? Mr. Vernich heard my title and he said, to the exact number. But I want to examine verses that give some hints. It's not what I would have thought at one time. At one time, if you'd asked me, like back in 1990, 94, and you said, how many do you think will go to a place of safety? I might have said, oh, 50,000, 75,000. Our attendance worldwide was running about 150,000. So that would have been my guess. I would probably change that guess and lower it a bit right now. Satan rebelled. He led a third of the angels into that rebellion and that division. Now, they're spirits and they're immortal and can never die. God has made human beings mortal. We can die. But He's allowing Satan to tempt us, just as He allowed Satan to tempt the angels, to see how many of them would... I mean, He allowed it. Adam and Eve were tempted. Very first humans. Cain. David. Jesus. So He allows Ananias and Sapphira. God allows Satan and the demons to tempt us. I want to read some verses just that you know well. I'm not going to turn to them. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. It's not human beings, though we might say, oh, this human being is our problem. No, it isn't. Against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. In the last chapter of Ephesians, He said that to the Ephesians. But I want to turn to Luke 18 and read the first 8 verses. And I'll just have to say that I look at it very differently. At one time, we would say, you know, at the end time, God's going to preach the gospel mightily. And it's true. And He'll probably have great miracles. And we'll preach the gospel with great might. And that's true too, but it's not the way we really thought. We know those great miracles will be done by the two witnesses. But what about up before the two witnesses? Will God's people be doing great miracles? You know, the Bible indicates there will be great miracles. But it's going to be by the bad guys, not the good guys. Notice Luke 18, verse 1. And this is a parable. And He has an introduction to it in verse 1. And then He has a conclusion to it in verse 7 and 8 at the end. So I want to read the whole thing and then go back to the introduction and then look at the conclusion. It says verse 1, then He spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart, saying, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to Him saying, get justice for me from my adversary. And He would not for a while, but afterward He said within Himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. In other words, hear what the parable says. And shall God not avenge His own elect who cry out day and night to Him, though He bears long with them? I tell you that He will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will He really find faith on the earth. Now, let's look at the entrance and the conclusion. Let's look at just one thing in the conclusion first. The very last statement is a question. And it gives the time setting. Now, this parable applies to Christians at any time. But he specifically sets a time at the end of it. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes. So this is really going to be something that happens, especially right at the end time. And he says, will he really find faith on the earth? Now, if we go back to the first verse, it says he spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. And we've seen two things at this time. The question is, will he find faith? That's talking about Christians. Why would Christians not have faith? You and I could say, oh, yes, there will be faith. Because we know that there will be people who will be in the place of safety. There will be people who are in the Laodiceans who may be giving up their lives. But, you know, it's a rhetorical question, not saying that there wouldn't be anybody. But really what he's asking is, how much faith is he going to find? Is there going to be a lot? And he only asked the question because it is a question. And he starts off saying that men ought to pray and not lose heart. Why would you lose heart or lose faith? Wouldn't it be if you don't see God acting, dealing, healing, doing great miracles? If God's doing great miracles at the end time, before the two witnesses, wouldn't everybody have faith? You know, I came into the church in 59. And there were just lots of healings. Basically, everybody was healed. I give you an example. There was a man in the church in Pasadena, Mr. Starkey. He was an older man. I thought of him as very old. He probably was my age. And he had cancer. And I know that it was so upsetting that a church member had cancer and he wasn't being healed. Can you imagine us being upset about that now? We'd be upset all day long, wouldn't we? But there was this one man who hadn't been healed. I can remember it was so upsetting that sermon after sermon was given about it, asking people to pray and have faith. I can remember Garner Ted Armstrong giving a sermon on it, and he just stopped his sermon. He says, I'm going to stop right now and we're going to pray. And he had everybody bow their head and they prayed for Mr. Starkey, because everybody else who got cancer was healed. And then Mr. Starkey died. And there was huge upset. Great discouragement. Well, what if we got discouraged to everybody who died of cancer now? And I know Garner Ted Armstrong came back, he gave a sermon, he said, you know something, why this has upset us? Because it's been years since any church member died. And we're just not used to it. But God's going to let people die. Can you see what a difference that was? I was ordained an elder in 1965 and got moved to Baltimore. And Guy Engelbart was the pastor. And he was in one room, I don't know if many of you have been around that long, but people lined up to talk to the pastor. And they had a deacon there, you know, having people lined up and sending one in after the other one left. But he had me do all the anointings while he did all the counseling. You know, I can't remember anybody who wasn't healed. That was very encouraging for a new elder. And I've seen people with cancer, heart disease, ruptured appendix, little girl up in New England. They went to the doctor. The doctor said, your appendix is ruptured. We're going to have to rush her to the hospital. Give her 50-50 chance, and that's all. They got in their car, and instead of taking her to the hospital, they went across the state lines from Rhode Island to Massachusetts and brought her into my house with a ruptured appendix. Peritonitis had already set in. Within 3 hours, she was completely well. That was not uncommon. Now, did we have faith? Were people losing heart? They weren't. And then it was just almost like a spigot was turned. The healings got fewer and fewer. We had some people being healed. One man in Florida had a stomach tumor. He got sick. He vomited and threw it up. Went by to anoint Daisy Baugh in Little Rock. The night before she was going to, in the hospital, going to have an operation, anointed her. So in the morning they did the ultrasound to absolutely pinpoint the tumor. It was gone. And we were having healing after healing. Then like a spigot, it was turned off. And you know, it's easy. I've gone to God and I have said to God, I'm discouraged. I've got this long list of people to pray for. I've got a little list of where I thank God of those who've been healed. Small. Most of the people who leave my prayer list by death. And I have said, you know, I mean, the church was growing. When I was in New England, I was getting 3 new visit requests a week on average. And we were just grow. Now, I haven't counted. I say, you know, I think we're doing more funerals than baptisms. And you think couldn't that make you not pray and lose heart? And when he comes, notice verse 7. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night? Honestly, we weren't even praying day and night for people to be healed. Except in rare cases. We had a little girl with a brain tumor up in New England. And we were praying for her and asking everybody to pray. And then my associate and I decided to take 2 days to fast. And just do as Mr. Armstrong did, an hour of prayer, an hour of meditation, an hour of Bible study, hour of prayer, hour of meditation, for 2 days. Other did sleep. At the end of the 2 days, that brain tumor began to go away, Lisa Jarris, and we had a feast. David's nodding his head, he remembers that. Well, Lisa was a twin, and we had a feast day over in Springfield, Massachusetts, and people hadn't noticed, because everybody was concerned about this girl. They didn't realize Lisa was there because she was a twin. So when they saw her, they didn't know if it was Lisa or her sister. And I remember announcing that she was completely well. The brain tumor had gone. Now, you know, you're not going to lose heart. But we did cry out day and night occasionally like that when there was something. Though he bears long with them. There's going to come a time, he's talking about when he comes, there's going to be a time of discouragement where we're going to have to pray day and night, and God is bearing long, and we've got to pray and not lose heart. Sounds like a contradiction when he turns around and says, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Is that a contradiction with bearing long? Now, what it means is, when he does intervene with the trumpet plagues and the seventh trump, he will avenge them speedily. So it'll be done. Some translations have quickly. But before that, he bears long. Some may be martyred. You remember that was one of the seals was martyrdom. And then there's the question he has. When the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? I have come to the conclusion. You know, I heard a sermon by Mark Mickelson. We were Wednesday night, we were going to watch and listen to the Bible study. I noticed some others said they tried that too, but they had a problem with the Bible study. It didn't come out. So we were sitting there and we were watching the screen and it said that there were problems. Please wait and try again later. And Lucretia and I talked about the sermon that Mark gave called Out of Africa. And Lucretia said, well, why don't we listen to that until the Bible study, they finally get the connection through the video. So we listened to it. And he came to some of the same conclusions that I have. That we are not going to see we're going to see some healings. But you know, it's going to be when people have cried out day and night. And it may be for quite a while that God will intervene. It's not going to come as easily. If God were performing lots of miracles, there'd be a lot of faith. There was when I saw lots of miracles when I came in the church for many, many years. But I see in the Bible times when God had great interventions and then times went by where He just wasn't doing anything. Not much. He's working with people, but not much was noticed. It wasn't in a great way. There were some great times. Moses, Elijah, Elisha, Jesus, Peter, Paul, when they did great miracles. And then there were other times throughout the Bible when there just wasn't much going on. And where's he? He's bearing long. Notice in Psalm 13, verse 1 and 2. Psalm 13, verse 1 and 2. We have so many places, and most of them in the Psalms, where the psalmist is crying out, why aren't you helping? Why are you letting your people get trodden down? Why are you allowing all this trouble? Why are you not listening to us? And they would often say, how long? And that's what he says here in Psalm 13, verse 1 and 2. Says it four times in just the two verses. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? This is not the quick answer. This is not the Elijah or Elisha or Moses kind of action. This is God testing us with discouragement, trying us with depressing things, unhappy things. Verse 2, how long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? See, not being delivered. How long will my enemy be exalted over me? And God just allows it to go on. It's a test. It's a trial. There are other places. Let me just read a few more, not turn to them. We do not see our signs. Well, this happens to be in Psalm 74, verse 10, verse 9 and 10. We do not see our signs. We don't see anything. We don't see you doing anything. There is no longer any prophet. You know, we see the times of the prophets and we see them in the Bible and we say God was having these powerful prophets. And yet, here in this psalm, he says, there's no longer any prophet. God just wasn't talking. Nor is there any among us who knows how long. Oh God, how long will the adversary reproach? Will the enemy blaspheme your name forever? In Psalm 79, verse 5, not going to turn there. I've got it written here. You don't have to turn there. How long, Lord, will you be angry forever? Can you imagine the discouragement? God allows that to test us. Discouraging things, just to see. I mean, God tested Abraham, didn't he? How long till we have this baby? They lost faith. Tried to do it on their own. See, how long will you be angry forever? Will your jealousy burn like fire? Psalm 80, verse 4. O Lord God of hosts, how long will you be angry against the prayer of your people? Imagine. I mean, he was so discouraged that he decided God was angry against the prayers. Psalm 89 and verse 46. How long, Lord, will you hide yourself forever? Will your wrath burn like fire? You know, that's in our hymn book on page 46. How long, this is from the hymn book. How long, Eternal, hide thou away? When will your wrath not burn like a fire? And then he says, thou God, remember, fleeting is life. Life's just fleeting, and how long are we going to wait? Where is the former love, O my God? Can you imagine somebody when God is testing, maybe for years and years, and saying, where's the former love? Where's all the love you showed to us? We don't see it. Recall, Eternal, your slave is scorned. Now I do bear insults of the world. Wherewith thy foes mock thy chosen ones. People making fun. You know, sometimes it appears that God looks down and he says, I'm checking to see. There are more. Psalm 90, verse 13. Return, O Lord, how long? And have compassion on your servants. Psalm 94, verse 3. Lord, how long will the wicked triumph? I want to turn to Revelation chapter 3 and verse 8. Revelation 3 and verse 8. This is something that was brought out actually back in the early 60s. Somebody was reading about the Philadelphia church, which we proudly proclaimed, proudly, or humbly, whichever, proclaimed we were the Philadelphians. That's humility. But Revelation 3, verse 8, there is a word in here. It says, I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Anybody remember the word strength? We emphasized it for a while. Anybody happen to remember what the Greek word is? Dunamis. Anybody remember that word now? Dunamis? Same word we get dynamite from. And you'd say, well, you have little strength. However, that word, dunamis, is translated, in the King James anyway, 11 times, mighty work. I mean, when somebody did a mighty work, a miracle. It's translated miracle 7 times. And it really referred to doing mighty miracles most of the time. Mighty work, miracle. You have little miracles, few miracles. And yet haven't denied God's name. Not great power. I mean, we think, well, the Philadelphians are going to do mighty works. Doesn't sound like it when you read this, does it? It's one of the lexicons has power for performing miracles. Jesus said, many are called. And what's the rest? fewer chosen. Now, you know, there was a time when God was calling, wasn't he? And since then, he's been choosing, sifting, testing, checking. And it's probably going to continue. Seems like God was doing more calling up until about 1990, before 1995. Seems like then, since he's doing less calling and more sifting. Well, I'll tell you what, 1995 was a real sifting, wasn't it? I want to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 1. You remember Eli and his two sons, his two evil sons. And there just weren't many miracles. Now, we know that God did powerful works through Samuel. But before Samuel, there just wasn't much going on in the way of prophecy or miracles. Samuel did miracles. God performed miracles through him. Had prophecies through him. But what about before then? We all want to live at a time where we have a Samuel or an Elijah or Elisha or a Moses. That's really nice. Great works, powerful broadcast. We have the open houses where the Bible lectures. And I pray to God to call people that will listen, that will not be hurt by knowing the truth, that will obey the truth. And we don't have many who come. I mean, I prayed that up in, we had people sign up for Bowling Green, something like 8 different ones were supposed to be there. Nobody showed up. Over in Jackson, a man who used to be in the church and who's doing his own work now had a bunch of people come to ours, but not anybody who was really new, and none of them continued. And we've had, about one very precious gentleman here who has come on a regular basis. But not a lot. Notice here in 1 Samuel 3, verse 1, "And the child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision." By precious, he means very, very little, very few, very far between. So there are times when God is dealing openly. He's still dealing with anybody who wants to draw close to him. But he doesn't necessarily do great, powerful things. Yet God was ready to do something powerful through Samuel. But it doesn't sound like he's ready to do it through the Philadelphia church. I don't know about the Laodiceans. Doesn't really say. Notice Proverbs 29 and verse 18. And we see that every now and then there is no revelation. Every now and then there are not great miracles. And it appears up till you get to the two witnesses, there will not be great miracles of God's people. Here in Proverbs 29, verse 18, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. Where there aren't great miracles, great powerful works, people cast off restraints. But happy is he who keeps the law. You know, those who cast off restraints are in contrast to those who are keeping the law. The majority of those who were keeping the law in 94 are apparently not today. And it just keeps going. The Holman Christian Standard Bible and the God's Word version have the people run wild. And we have run wild. I say we. Many have run wild. We've gone through discouraging times, including divisions, people getting sick and dying, young people. Yet we often read at funerals, "The righteous perishes, and no man takes it to heart. Merciful men are taken away, while no one considers that the righteous is taken away from evil. He shall enter into peace." The evil to come, and is in the King James. And so it looks even here. This is Isaiah 57, verse 1 and 2. Even there, it looks like God, before the end time, before the tribulation, is going to let many people just die in the faith. That may sound discouraging. God does heal. There are some that He has healed still. But I'll tell you what, it takes person crying out day and night. In the Olivet Prophecy, we find out that the bad guys will be doing miracles. Now, we read it. It's in Matthew 24, in Mark 13, in Luke 21, where they asked Him, "What will be the sign of Your coming, the end of the age?" First thing Jesus said, "Take heed that no one deceives you." Meaning, just before the end, here's one of the signs. There'll be deceivers. "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many." God's going to allow prophets, maybe telling prophecies that come true, and deceive many. "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." There's a prophecy of the end time. You know, if God's people, God's servants are doing great miracles, they might not turn aside and grow cold. "But he who endures to the end shall be saved." It's going to be an endurance. And we are already enduring, in my opinion. And then he also says, "For false Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." Some say, well, that doesn't mean it's not possible. No, it's not saying it's impossible. God's going to allow the bad guys to have the signs and wonders to see if it's possible to deceive the elect. Because he's not doing the calling that so much at that time. He's doing the choosing. Jesus prayed that we all be one, as the Father and He were one. That we be one just as Jesus and the Father are one. God's allowing not oneness, but division. There's an interesting verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 19, that we read most of the time at Passover. And there's an interesting word here that is an interesting word in the Greek, just like that word dunamis. This is the word doikos. And it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 19. It says, "For there must be factions among you." That is divisions. Some have translated it divisions. So if you think the division is extremely discouraging, I think most people feel it is. Most groups feel it is. That the division is discouraging. It says, "There must also be factions among you, that those who are approved." Now the word there is doikomos. And it's an adjective. And it means genuine. It means genuine. It's often translated genuine, dokimos. That those who are genuine may be recognized among you. It's translated genuine in the English Standard Version, God's Word Version, International Standard Version. In the ancient banking system, they used to have coins, and people would come along, and, you know, so they were mostly pure silver, and they would just cut a little off of each coin right on the edge. But those bankers, money changers who would only deal with coins that were full weight were called doikomos. They were genuine. And not counterfeit. But notice that same word, basic word, is used as a noun form in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6 and 7. God allows trials. And here's the same Greek word, but this is the noun version of it. Here's the difference. The word is genuine as an adjective that we read in 1 Corinthians 11, 19. And here it's the noun version, genuineness. But it's the same great Greek word, just the noun version of it. And he says in verse 6, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now, for a little while," this is not the only time, there were times back then also that God allowed terrible trials. "Though now for a little while, if need be," and there sometimes is a need, "you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness," doikmenion, same basic word, but the noun version, "the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it be tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ." God is allowing division. Boy, is He ever. And I really suspect it's going to continue. And people say, "Why can't we get together?" And I think God's going to allow us, now I do, to have more division in the future. I don't think He's quit sifting. I don't think He's quit choosing. Now, I'm not saying we're the approved ones, and all those people over there are not genuine. I think they're genuine people. But why did they go to that group or stay with this group? And what about the leaders? Let me just say, I don't judge any of them. I'm not their judge. You aren't their judge. But I do know that I don't want to stand before Jesus Christ and answer for having divided a congregation. Now, that's me. Somebody else will say, "Well, I had to do this." He has to answer to God. I have to answer to God. But God's allowing it to see those who are approved are genuine. But he says this, Paul wrote, "For you are to the Corinthians, for you are still carnal. For where there are envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men?" God's checking on this division. I don't think you caused any of the division. I don't think anybody in here did. But how are we acting? How do we feel about our brothers and sisters? Do we speak evil of them? Are we putting them down? Or are we hoping for reconciliation? "For when one says, 'I am of Paul,' and another, 'I am of Apollos,' are you not carnal?" Let me just say, now I want to say something nice that I like about United. I'm not trying to put any other group down. But we do tend to do, for shorthand, when instead of saying the name of this group or that group or that group or that group, we'll say, "Oh, that's Mr. So-and-so's group," or "Mr. So-and-so's group," or "Mr. So-and-so's group," don't we? You know, "I'm of so-and-so, I'm of so-and-so, I'm of so-and-so." Well, one thing I appreciate about United is that you don't say, this is Mr. So-and-so's group. Because who would you put in? Would you put Denny Luker? Well, his presidency is for 3 years, which ends in June next year. And there may be somebody else. So will we now say, well, it's no longer Denny Luker? It's not Denny Luker's group, is it? He's not the one in charge. And anything he says goes. So, I appreciate that. Other groups feel one man should be in charge, and that's their privilege. That's their privilege. But he says, when one says, I'm of Paul, and another, I'm of Apollos, are you not carnal? That's in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3 and 4. Okay. I want to read this. Strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will see. While we're doing this, turn to Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 17 and 19. Because this is a split sermon, and I'm going to finish in a few minutes. Strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek. That's a word that means to seek. To enter and will not be able. But when it says strive to enter through the narrow gate, that's a different word. It's the word we get agonize from. Agonizmai. It means to struggle. So it's a real struggle. It's going to be a struggle for us. But here's the good news. Every last person in this room can be chosen. Not just to go to the place of safety. I gave it that title because I thought that would be interesting to you. Or to be in God's kingdom, which is the important thing. Everybody in here can be in God's kingdom. Everybody in this room can be chosen. But the attitude of Habakkuk is the attitude we all are going to need before the end time. Some of us may get sick and die, and that includes me. Because it said, the righteous perish. Well, I hope I'm righteous, and if God allows me to die in the faith, boy, I'll just sleep right through the tribulation. Sounds like a nice, that's a shortcut. Everybody else has to go the long way. Habakkuk 3, verse 17 through 19. Here's the attitude we all need. Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines. Though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food. Though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on my high hills.